Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Good morning, Jim and Austin. A lot's been happening with Iran recently, and there's been the talk of the shutting down the Straits of Hormuz. There's been talk about Israel going up against them. How have things evolved here over the last couple of months? I think we talked about them towards the first of the new year, maybe the end of last year. Where do things stand now, Jim?
Well, the problem in Iran is that you have a clerical dictatorship which is desperately trying to hang on to its power. At the same time, as part of the infighting among factions within the government, you have a guy like President Ahmadinejad, who's on his way out, by the way, which is another story we'll get to in a second, enjoyed playing the nationalism card and the religious fanatic card, which helped him mainly internally inside of Iran. But what he ended up saying was, Israel must be destroyed, and we will do it. Now, normally, a head of state does not say that about another state. He's being condemned roundly, but he doesn't really care, because what he's really doing is appealing to both voters, which is a little irrelevant, but I'll get to that in a second, and various other factions within the Iranian government, which is basically run by clerics. The most senior clerics, because of something they slipped into a constitutional change in the 1980s when they were at war with Iraq and everybody was scared, the senior clerics have a veto power over any government decision. They can decide who can run for office. If a law is passed and signed by the president, they can cancel it. If a judge says something, they can say, no, you can't do that. So that's a lot of power. Plus, they control the police and their own private army. That is not so bad, except that the clerics became very corrupt, them and their families. The clergy obviously can be married, and they have children and grandchildren and all sorts of people who want a favor from grandpa, and grandpa's inclined to give it. They're not all corrupt, but enough of them are corrupt that the economy is crippled. There's been constant, job shortages, inflation. People could see, that if you didn't have a connection, with a mullah, a senior cleric, you could not take a good idea and run with it. So the sharpest people have been running to Europe and America, because you simply can't run a business without dealing with all the corruption. And that's not an efficient way to run. So Ahmadinejad is basically an anti-corruption guy. Now, normally you'd say, well, he must be suicidal. But he really isn't, because there are factions, even among the clergy, who believe that all this corruption is haram, forbidden. You shouldn't do it. And it is bad. Most Iranians say, hey, look, this is not right. But it's entrenched. These people have their family obligations. It's funny in a perverse way, the way this operates. When they overthrew the Shah, the monarchy, and the nobility in general, in 1979, early 80s, all of the royal properties were put into charitable trusts, and these trusts are controlled by clerics. So you can see where that went. So all this money, which has grown, they have brought in good managers and what have you to invest it and put it in business, but it was all done with an eye towards enriching the clerics and their families. This is no secret in Iran. The problem is, how do we stop it? Ahmadinejad had an idea, and he was very popular, and he was somewhat untouchable, but that's why he's threatening to destroy Israel, because this basically gives him some leverage with the middling fanatic, or the very fanatic, shall we say, clergy and what have you, saying, look, this guy is one of us. He wants to destroy Israel. And then the nuclear weapons program comes in, which, of course, they deny, but everybody inside Iran talks about it like it's real. And isn't it great? Because all Iranians believe that Iran is a great place. It's been an empire for thousands of years. You know, that's a fact. They've been the superpower in that neighborhood for thousands of years. That's a fact. And the Iranians feel that they're not getting the respect due to them from these Novoo-ish, you know, these Beverly Hillbilly type, you know, Arabs over there with all their oil. So this creates a bit of tension. And Ahmadinejad has been, you know, looking for support. Now, Israel, in the meantime, is nervous about all this talk. Israel knows a lot about Iran, because most of the Iranian Jews who've been there for thousands of years have been, you know, tossed out over the last, 50 years. Not all at once, but bit by bit, it became more and more difficult for any non-Shia Muslim to live in Iran. A lot of these Iranian Jews have friends still, not necessarily Jewish, back in Iran. They stay in touch. They still speak Farsi. So Israel has this resource which has a deep, detailed understanding of what is really going on at the grassroots level in Iran. So they know that Iranians do not want to get into a nuclear war, but they also know that there is a segment of the population, it's small, 10-20%, depending on how you want to, you know, count someone as a religious fanatic, who do believe in this kind of thing. Now, what you got to understand is the majority of Iranians, and by Iranian tradition, you do not do stupid things like get involved in a nuclear war. That's just taken for granted. But the fact that these fanatics have such power within is scary, and the Israelis are scared. I mean, if they believed that it was life and death right now, they would have bombed. They would be bombing Iran on a regular basis. They don't. I'm not sure, but in Israel, again, local politics, this is real. You know, you can be sort of abstract about it in Europe and the United States, but if you're living in Ground Zero, you take a different look at the situation. So the biggest change recently is the feud that's been between Ahmadinejad and his basically pro-reform, anti-corruption allies, which span, you know, the full spectrum of Iranian politics, and the senior clerics and the basically the corrupt clerics, which again is a large group from fairly junior to very senior, you know, religious leaders. Came to a head in the recent parliamentary elections, and people saw this coming. Months ago, the senior mullahs started systematically knocking out any candidate that they thought would not be on the side of corruption, on the dark side, shall we say. And when the elections took place, sure enough, 75% of the people who got elected went in there and said, we're for, you know, tradition. In other words, theft and stealing and corruption and what have you. It's interesting, though, they didn't get 100% because there were a lot of candidates who were, you know, sort of, well, okay, I'm this, I'm that. And then, of course, once they got elected, they came in there saying, hey, you know, we need some change. So this slow-motion revolution, this incomprehensible revolution that's been going on for a decade is still on the way. But Ahmadinejad is on the way out. And nobody knows exactly what's going to replace him. Now, the Israelis are thinking to themselves, they might even, you know, Netanyahu might have even said this to Obama recently. If Ahmadinejad goes, his replacement might not be inclined to keep playing West nuke Israel card because it's getting old. And a lot of senior clerics in Iran have been saying openly and privately, you know, this is not good for Iran. I mean, even a lot of the corrupt clerics are statesmen, shall we say. I mean, they know what's best for Iran as long as they and their family continue to be rich. And they're not inclined to get involved in messy situations which could have blowback. One of those is closing the Straits of Hormuz. This is basically a myth. This is showbiz. This is along the same lines as let's nuke Israel. It would do more harm to Iran than it would to anybody else, because they're facing an enormous disparity in military power. Now they say, yeah, we got thousands of these Chinese anti-ship missiles, which are basically second-rate versions of Harpoon, but they do work. Not as frequently as Western missiles, but often enough. But the obvious tactic, I mean, if you know anything about, you know, military strategy and operations, the obvious tactic is basically put your aircraft, get air superiority, you know, utterly destroy the Iranian Air Force, take down their air defense system. Now, and again, anybody in the business knows America is most capable of doing that sort of thing. And then you basically go hunting. Basically, the coastal areas where you can launch missiles from becomes a no-drive zone. Now, of course, the Iranians will be out there taking pictures of, you know, truckloads of women and children. They'll arrange to come, you know, down at 3 a.m. down to a coastal road. But be that as it may, if you want to keep those shipping lanes open, and it's a small area by the straits, because once you get into the Gulf, you can glide by the Arab side, and you're out of range of most of these missiles. You basically can try to, and in the meantime, the air power, the combined air forces of, you know, the local United States forces plus the Saudi Arabians, everybody else, they can bomb the crap out of anything military the Iranians have, with the implied threat that if Iranian doesn't say uncle, we will start going after the oil facilities, which means they're going to have no oil for a decade or longer. Now, at the same time, there is an oil surplus. I know the gasoline, you know, rates are going up and stuff like that, but that's got more to do with other factors, which I won't get into here because they're too technical. But basically, you know, the United States is on its way to becoming a net exporter of petroleum products again. Iranians only export about 2 point something million barrels a day, and there's more than enough to cover that, you know, in world capacity. So they're not making any real threats. In fact, to give you an idea of how the world sees the Iranian threat, the latest round of sanctions, which are pretty severe, they're cutting them off from the world banking system and not allowing them to import or export much, they're not allowing them, basically, to sell their oil. Now, if their oil supply was so critical to oil prices and oil supplies, why would basically almost the entire world do that? So it's a real number. It's not just some wahoo from strategy page, you know, bloviating. It's real. So the Iranians have a lot of problems. And what all we see outside of Iran is things they do for internal politics that are directed at internal and really have nothing to do with what they're actually talking about. So when they talk about closing the Straits of Hormuz or destroying Israel, they don't really mean it. And, you know, anybody who knows the history of Iran knows they don't really mean it. But there are enough wahoos, you know, maniacs, Islamic radicals, or just radicals in general, inside the Iranian government that there is a remote, not an impossibly remote, but a remote possibility that somebody could, you know, get themselves to the buttons, so to speak, if a button actually exists, and push it and make something happen. So it's just scary enough to be really scary to a lot of people. But on a practical matter, the big problem is internal politics and whether or not the religious dictatorship can hang on after all the grief they've inflicted upon the Iranian people. And that's where the real war is going on.
Austin?
Well, we've talked in some detail through various Hormuz scenarios. I think, you know, I want to say maybe 3 months ago, I even talked about how some of the ways of using mines, small boats, and the like with the swarm attacks, all of these capabilities exist. Jim's given you a strategic overlay. Couple things I would point out. Yeah, the U.S. is probably on its way to where it is a exporter of oil and natural gas, but I think we're still, because of internal, we talked about internal politics, domestic politics in Iran, domestic politics in the United States, despite the success of fracking and the discovery of all these oil shales that could be productive. You've still got a tremendous capital outlay to make that productive. So you're looking, Dan, and I'm pulling this off of maybe 8 or 9 lengthy analyses that I've read about fracking. I guess that goes with being a Texan, that you would read about fracking on the and it, not simply being able to acquire the drilling rights, drill it, and then then produce it. But you're looking at a decade, 12, 15 years, and without going into the America's local politics on it, we'll consider the battle going on over the Canada to Texas pipeline. Right, whether it's going to get built or not, and no, that is not specifically to dealing with U.S. Continental U.S. Fields. You've still got, there's an example of the political battle going on over that pipeline. Still, it is Jim's macro analysis of the Iranian oil production. You're seeing right now that the world is able to get by. Saudi Arabia has a great deal of swing capacity, something that is mentioned in a few places. It's been mentioned on strategy page, but it's mentioned in the, what I'll call, among the cognoscente, and the is that Iraq is slowly increasing its export capacities. So there's some slack in the system if you continue to squeeze Iran and Iran's exporting capabilities. Now, let me give you another scenario that might make it seem a little less distant than the way than Jim's treatment. Let's say you are squeezing Iran fairly successfully, and I just point out within the last week, Russia and China joined Great Britain, France, I think Germany's in it, and the United States, and this an appeal to Tehran to permit more UN inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, to go in and look at one of these facilities that's, I forget the name of it, but it's south of Tehran, and it's there are satellite photos of this that are all over the internet, actually. But it's to come in and so they can international inspectors can check it out, because it is a nuclear research facility that may be involved in I believe it's nuclear weapons testing or the like. Okay, well, I feel pretty certain. It's speculation on my part, though, that the Israelis and the United States and the Russians know that it is involved in nuclear weapons testing. Doesn't mean just because they're, and I don't know what degree, maybe it could be triggers or whatever. I don't know that, but it's indication that it is indeed that site is likely used for that. Doesn't mean by the time the inspectors show up that the evidence is available, but what you've got here is the United States and the UK beginning to nudge Russia and China into agreeing to depending on how the Iranians react. I mean, this is a kabuki theater thing. They say yes, come on in, but then, oh, they didn't fulfill it, blah blah blah. But you nudge Russia and China into agreeing to harsher sanctions. Of course, Russia's benefiting on this because they're a huge oil and gas exporter. They make a lot of money on it. Bumping prices, it's to Russia's benefit. The Iranians know that. They know the Russians are their old enemies as well. China, if China finds that it can get the other capacity from Sudan, of course, South Sudan is limiting its oil production. It claims to have taken it all off the market right now because of its conflict going on with the Republic of Sudan. So there are all these other little edge conflicts that affect the price of oil. But you can bump exports from someplace else. China goes along with it. All they're concerned really about is keeping their economic machine Well-oiled. All right. I was going to get back to the scenario. So you're restricting Iran's ability to sell oil. Let's say one of these fanatics. I thought it was really kind of funny. Jim used the term, what was it, middling fanatics? And then you decided that, well, they're just out-and-out nuts. I'm going to go with out-and-out nuts. And I know that's what Jim thinks too. These guys say, hey, we have nothing to lose. And local action at Hormuz, you've got your fellow zealots there, and they proceed. In other words, I'm talking about a lurch here to try to draw the rest of the country into supporting them. See the political, the domestic political component here. Says, hey, we're losing money anyway. We're going to do something about it. We're just going to show these Arabs and the rest of the world we will act to defend our interests. So they, what of it? Small boat attacks, mines. Well, who knows? Maybe they've got the local commander there at Bandar al-Abbas. Making that up, Dan, but you see, I told you I was building a scenario. So they actually at least make more than a symbolic effort. It's beyond rhetoric. Oil prices bump up. It doesn't last, because as long as the United States decides to respond, what if the Obama administration doesn't decide to respond, okay? But instead of laying out there that if the United States decides to respond, you're going to clear that channel. What is the domestic reaction inside Iran? I don't know, but you know there are a lot of ways it could go, especially if the radicals feel that, hey, we're on the wrong end of a long-term losing game, which Jim outlined. Now, Jim, he said last decade. I can show you material written in 1994, 1995, some of it used in the 1996 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War by James F. Dunnigan and Austin Bay, that some of these issues were already in play. The disgust with the corruption of the clerical regime. Is there anybody who's going to help us change this despicable regime? All right, that's 15, 16, 17 years ago. And it's increasing. 2009, you saw it. And, of course, we've seen repression in the last 3 years on the green movement. Some of the repressive techniques you see being used in Syria. The Iranians are advising the Syrians on that. How you instead of shutting down the Internet, you use it as a way to track dissidents and find them. But there's a case to be made. I've made it. I even think we discussed it on Strategy Talk one time, that the Iranians see the fight in Syria as I'm talking about the regime in Iran sees the fight in Syria as something of an analog to their own situation in Iran. And if you can beat it in Syria, maybe it won't happen in Iran. But back to my radical element making their move. Instead of sitting there and just losing over the long term, we're going to act now and see if we can't get away with it. Now, that is part. I've done that with oil. That's what goes through the minds of Israelis vis-a-vis a nuclear attack, which we got to be ready for it. They are nuts. And unlike the rest of the world, unlike the United States, which the regime can't get to, and right, even though they threatened to attack, I'm talking the Iranian regime, it's threatened that there'd be terror attacks if the United States responded, etc. But Israel is, what did Ahmadinejad call it? Jim Dunnigan, do you remember? A one-bomb state? The Israelis have to take it seriously. I think that was his term, wasn't it? I'm sure it was. Yeah.
So that's although, as we point out, just having a nuclear weapon is not enough. It can take you even longer to basically refine that explosive device so that it can survive being used in a ballistic missile. This is something people don't like to talk about because it's not news. It means even if they have a weapon, you can't use it for 10 years? I says, well, yeah, something like that. But the way the news business works, everything is right away. Everything is immediate. When in reality, as we know at Strategy Page, things tend to take a little longer. Actually, anybody who's built a house or redone their kitchen knows that, but it's somehow that reality doesn't apply to the news business, but that's another story.
Dan, just for what it's worth, I looked up on the web, on my computer, the name of that site south of Tehran. It's Parchin, P-A-R-C-H-I-N. That's the name of that site that nations that I was mentioning have, U.S., U.K., China, Russia, Germany, were once inspectors to look at. So.
Right. Now, Jim, the Israelis have probably been using covert efforts to slow down the nuclear program. Is that correct?
Nobody's admitting anything, but it certainly looks that way. A lot of key people in the Iranian nuclear energy or weapons department have been dying. Some of them of rather obviously, you know, 007, you know, site using 007, you know, the secret agent type methods. So, yeah, there is a secret war going on. But that by itself, despite some very senior people getting killed, is not going to stop it. But it certainly makes the Iranians nervous, which I guess is the main goal of that operation, if it indeed is an operation and not some really cosmic coincidence.
Right. Well, at least the belief is that Stuxnet actually did slow it down to some degree, right?
Yes, and from what I've been hearing from down in NSA land or what have you, some people are starting to pat themselves on the back. The feeling is it was a good idea, but nobody really knows if there was any follow-up, which bespeaks, you know, some pretty good security. In other words, the people who are patting themselves on the back are simply, you know, taking a round of applause because everybody knows who did it or who was involved in it. The Israelis, of course, you know, are, from what I've been told, some of them have been, you know, patting themselves on the back. So this, it may be the case that the usual suspects were indeed responsible. But it was no, just like the assassinations, it was no game changer by itself. But then again, it's a war of inches. So if this slows him, if Stuxnet slows him down 4 months, if an assassination slows him down, you know, overall a month, a year, you know, it adds up. And what the Iranians are worried about is before they get their bomb, or, you know, basically get the test, which is, that's when you can officially declare you have a bomb. You really haven't got a bomb because you haven't got it in a missile warhead that you can deliver somewhere. But that's, again, playing the news, not the reality angle of it. As long as you can stop them from getting to that point, you know, you're ahead on points.
Right. Now, Israel's reaction, if they if a nuclear test actually was announced and it was successful, unlike what's happened in North Korea, what do you think Israel's reaction to that would be, Jim? And then we'll let Austin.
Two things are going to happen here. First, the Israelis are going to adjust their clock, you know, which estimates the time at which they have to be worried about a real nuclear warhead landing on Tel Aviv to be, you know, 4 or 5 or maybe more years. In other words, how long will it take the Iranians to engineer it? To the point where it will survive being fired by a, you know, a ballistic missile and actually operating, you know, detonating over the target area. And at that point, the second thing the Israelis have to decide, well, is it being this close, you know, to doomsday, should we, you know, let the bombers go and just basically crank up, you know, operations? The problem is attacking Iran plays into the hands of the hardliners. This makes them instant martyrs, even though they're, none of them are probably going to get killed. But it basically mobilizes the nation, all the people who are angry at the corrupt, you know, clerics, suddenly cuts them a lot of slack and says, hey, you know, these damn Jews are trying to take away our nukes, you know, Iran. I mean, basically, Iranians say words to the effect that we deserve nukes. You know, it's long overdue. I mean, that's how they look at it, for nationalism, you know, and several other reasons. So if you want to delay the revolution in Iran, the best way to do it is to bomb their nuclear facilities. So you see the situation that Israel is caught in. The risk of some maniac, you know, actually popping a nuke that will, once a test has been conducted, a certain number of years it will take to engineer it to the point where it might work. You know, even a lot of these ballistic missile designs are tricky. in the United States, for example, and in Russia, they found, after, I think in the United States case, it was one case 18 months, hundreds of America's ballistic missiles would not work because there was a flaw everybody missed. Somebody made a change, et cetera, et cetera. And then one day somebody had an oh crap moment, said, oh my God. You know, that's one reason why you want a couple thousand of these things, because you never know, of different models, because you never know when somebody will screw up, you know, in an upgrade. You know, that's like in the computer business. You don't be the first one to go and get the next version of the operating system because you know something's wrong in there. Wait a few months. It's the same way with ballistic missiles. And it's very much the same way with, you know, a small country that's only got one. They haven't got ballistic missile or a nuclear weapon when they detonate one. They simply have a threat of having one that's closer. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. So the Israelis are not going to freak out when that test happens, but they have to realize that they're that another milestone has been crossed, and they have to deal with that. And there are other ways they can deal with that, you know, supporting the sanctions, war, James Bond stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But really, the last thing you want to do is make the corrupt mullahs look like good guys. And that's what the bombing does.
Right. Austin, you want to wrap us up and bring us to a conclusion?
I like the way Jim put it. Let me just add another dimension on this. The Israelis know that this is for a long time, they've known it's a long-term threat, hence their emphasis on ballistic missile defense, their cooperation with the U.S. Missile defense programs, but they've also pushed the envelope with their various systems. So they see themselves as vulnerable from that. Well, of course, not just Iran. They suffered ballistic missile attack, as inept as it was, in 1991 in the Kuwait War, Persian Gulf War. So did Saudi Arabia. So they want, and they also know that even though it's unlikely that the Iranians could try a sneak nuclear attack with a cruise missile with a nuclear weapon launched from the Mediterranean, may seem unlikely, has a lot of technological issues with it, and of course an Iranian ship would be watched, but he says it has to be an Iranian ship. The Israelis have to think about these seemingly edgy, I won't say outlandish, but seemingly edgy scenarios. What that takes then is that they can't just watch in the direction of Iran. They have to have a 360 capability. One other point, and I'll come back to the missile defense. I do note that the hammering of the Assad regime has had some interesting effects, at least on the public diplomacy of Hamas. That Hamas has said over the last couple of weeks, and there was an interesting piece in the BBC webpage about 5 or 6 days ago, which I commend, recommend, that Hamas said, you know, we're not tied to the Iranian regime. If Syria collapses, who's going to support, where would they be supported? Who knows? There have been a lot of attempts by the Saudis, the Turks, and the Egyptians, at least Egyptians prior to the collapse of the Mubarak regime, to try to pry Hamas away from the Iranians, playing the Sunni card against the Shia or Iranians. Well, maybe that's happening. What it does for the Israelis is lessen the dimension that a Hamas, you'd get an Iranian attack from territory controlled by a Hamas. It might even be happening with Hezbollah. Just point that relationship out. The signal that's sent ultimately to Iranians is, boy, we've got a serious fight in our hands for our influence in Iran. Back to the, it has implications too for now, where I'm going to wind up with the missile defense. The Israelis have invested a lot of money in this. They've got something that we have indications, and I'm only reading from open source on this, but recall I was a reservist in the Clinton administration, was the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, so I'm aware of some of the operational issues very much aware of the operational issues on missile defense, that the Israelis, basically what I say in the open press, the Israelis have operational capabilities that are good, getting better. In other words, they're investing for that, have a defensive capability should that wacko get in charge of a nuclear capability in Tehran and the attack comes. So I'd add that on to Jim's point about it might be in the distance, but the Israelis are looking to run a long-distance race themselves. They don't want to rely. No one wants to rely on a missile defense system as your because it's your last it's your last ditch effort. It's your your final fires. The Israelis would the ideal outcome, of course, Dan, is the diplomatic squeeze that either draws the bomb away from the Ayatollah's hands, or heck, the ultimate one is the Green Movement takes over and says, "Hey, we don't want to mess with our neighbors. We're more interested in making money and doing it honestly and developing as a society instead of exporting Khomeiniist Islamic revolution and having, you know, 98% of the world angry with us." So, but can that happen? Well, there are people out there who are trying to promote that diplomatically and politically. So I will conclude with that.
We'll definitely be following all that. Thank you again, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
See you later.
Bye.